from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Joan Walsh grew up in an Irish middle-class family in New York, but she says her relatives, working-class relatives, went from Kennedy Democrats to voting for Nixon. So why did so many working-class families defect from the Democratic Party? And why does Walsh think their vision of the American dream has kept the country from becoming what she calls a truly multiracial America? Joan Walsh joins us to discuss her new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And we'll talk with her about her thoughts on the white middle class and what their impact will be on the elections. She's editor-at-large of Salon.com, and Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. San Francisco-based writer Joan Walsh, a former editor-in-chief and present editor-at-large with Salon.com, is a regular political commentator on MSNBC. She recently published What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. It's a historic look at the role government has played with class and racial divisions in the United States. It's also a family memoir of her New York-based Irish Catholic family. Joan Walsh has written for Vogue, The Nation, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and The San Francisco Chronicle, and she joins us in studio for this opening hour forum. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you leave out the South, I guess this white working class is a lot less conservative than perhaps most people think.
Exactly. I've really been heartened by the studies that are coming out in the last couple of weeks. It's partly Mitt Romney. It's not necessarily anything the Democrats are doing, but Mitt Romney is really making plain the agenda of the Republican Party and who it represents. But I think it's also something that's been going on in the last 8 years. You know, several things motivated the book, and one was wanting to tell this story of how the white working class, including much of my family, fell away from the Democratic Party. But another thing was seeing that people were beginning to come back and that people were opening their minds to the Democratic message, especially in the wake of what George Bush did and didn't accomplish, and finding that people on the left, liberals, Democrats, were very suspicious of that theory and very reluctant to give up their stereotypes of the white working class as kind of implacably racist and backwards. So these studies that are coming out in the last few weeks, even today, Reuters says that white seniors are rushing away from Mitt Romney. If the Republicans lose white seniors, they are not a national party anymore.
Well, many of those white seniors don't pay taxes, so they feel themselves perhaps branded as part of that 47%.
Those moochers,
right. There's also a kind of maybe white liberal elitism about this cliche that if they only knew it was in their best interest, they would vote Democratic. And that is kind of condescending in many respects. But it's also true that most of that white working class wants higher tax rates for the rich, and they, feel that the rich are too advantaged, and they're not.
They do. And I think Democrats sometimes comfort themselves by saying that polling shows that every group except the very rich and the very conservative do want higher taxes. They support a lot of the Democratic message, but then they don't necessarily, come November, vote Democratic. And I think what I tried to explain in the book is that there grew up a skepticism around whether the Democratic Party actually represented the interests of working people of every race in the 60s and 70s that has persisted through today. I do think that Democrats and Barack Obama have an opportunity to change that, and they've gone some ways in changing it. But as the party became more the party of Wall Street, there was a reason for some of that skepticism about whether the Democrats were really the people who had the interests of the working and middle classes in mind.
I think, as I said before, President Obama is getting as much in his coffers almost from Wall Street as Mitt Romney is.
He got more than John McCain by far, and he's catching up now. I mean, as Mitt Romney looks more and more like a loser. I don't want to jinx anything, and I think people still have to worry. But, you know, they go with the winner. So they really can't afford to only give to Mitt Romney if it really looks like an Obama landslide that can't be left out.
Well, as you've pointed out, Obama had more voters from the Democratic side than John Kerry, than Al Gore, than Mike Dukakis.
More white voters.
More white voters from this class we're talking about, right?
Right?
Mondale and even second-term Carter. But, of course, that has shifted, and one has to ask how many of those voters are going to vote for Obama again in this next term.
I don't think we know, but I do see signs that they are shifting back, that they definitely swung way to the right in 2010. Whatever open-mindedness they had toward the president and toward the Democrats in 2008, they really lost it in 2010. But again, you know, I got into a lot of scuffles with my liberal friends about why that was. And, you know, a lot of people, it was as though, oh, did they become more racist or did the president become more black? In fact, they had reasons to be disappointed in the president's job. I don't hold him solely accountable. He had a recalcitrant Congress. Even Democrats in Congress were not always his friend. That Blue Dog Caucus was as good as Republicans on a lot of economic issues. But I think that he wasn't as hard on Wall Street as he could have been, that people were really frustrated about going into that election with a roughly 10% unemployment. That's a very hard case to make to working class people of any race. A lot of Latinos and African Americans and younger people stayed home.
So how much credence do you give to what we keep hearing as the sort of nascent racism that reared its ugly head after 4 years or during the course of the 4-year term that President Obama has served?
Oh, during the course of the 1 month that he served? No, I mean, this is the Obama paradox that I write about. It was an amazing victory for American exceptionalism, to use that term, to elect our first black president, African-American president, and also to elect him with such numbers. But it's really unmistakable that there was an immediate backlash. Immediate. I mean, I actually went to the first Tea Party. It was a San Francisco Tea Party, I admit it, but still it was like 250 people from mainly the peninsula and Marin, God bless them. You know, I really was trying to see, is there any common ground with some liberal critiques of the president and of the Democratic Party? No. I met my first birther. You know, there was such a racial subtext, even in San Francisco. And then when you traveled outside of more blue states, the racism was just unmistakable. So
do you think the birther thing was largely emanated from racism?
I do.
Because there are those who say, well, it's kind of questionable. Was he born in Kenya? Or there are these stories that bop up like wildflowers everywhere, or weeds maybe. The assumption is perhaps we don't know enough about him. There's not enough information. Ergo, he's not following the Constitution. Or is it the jump because he's black?
He looks different. I don't think if he were quite honestly, I think there's something to what you're saying in the sense that he does have a funny name and he's not African American in the traditional sense. I think that if he were the son of an African American family, it would have been this particular trope would have been less popular. The notion it's easier to claim that he wasn't born here because his father was Kenyan. So I do see that there's some of that. And yet there's such a persistent otherism in so much of their invective against him. And it really is. I also think I can say this in San Francisco. I once said this on Hardball with Willie Brown, and I thought he was going to die. I think that the attention to birtherism and the condition of his birth had something to do with calling attention to the fact that it was an interracial coupling, you know, so that like talking about his birth.
The old miscegenation taboo.
Yes, I may be the only one in the world who thinks that. But there's something about birth. Why are we talking about his birth? You know, it's constantly calling our attention back to all these things that make very conservative right-wing and perhaps racist people very, very uncomfortable.
This is why you become such a TV star. You see things from a different angle. And we're talking to Joan Walsh. Her new book is What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And we'll talk about that golden age, but let's talk first. I like the fact that you've written in what I call a hybrid book. You know, it's really, we go all the way back to the Bacon Rebellion in 1676 in New York City, draft riots in 1863, and all these things as you kind of trace a historical continuum. But in my mind, of course, a lot of this comes to center around John Mitchell's Southern strategy and around the hard hats. I mean, that's more, I guess, my historical memory of what I've lived through. But your own sense of the shift in your own family from JFK Democrats to Nixon Republicans, which I mentioned earlier, a lot of that had to do with social issues and what were perceived as moral issues, or what Pat Buchanan, another Irish Catholic working class guy, called cultural issues.
Right.
what you're talking about in the book, it seems to me, is in spite of the fact that now those – you mentioned recent polls, for example. What is it, the Public Religion Research Institute study that has the vote that best serves you in terms of, you know, abortion or same-sex marriage. What do we have, a white working class, like 27% or maybe a quarter who said that, who answered yes to that?
Right. Right.
It's
much
lower.
And it's only 1 in 20 who say that's the issue on which they vote. It's only 1 in 20, and we have this notion that that's what's driving the white working class. So I think we've got a lot of old stereotypes, but I think it's really...
Excuse me, the other surprise is how many watch Fox News, just talking about you as a TV star. That's kind of a twist.
What surprised me about that study was that an equal percentage of white working class voters and white college educated voters consider Fox News their main news source. So again, we condescend and stereotype to these dumb white working class people. I'm sorry, white college educated people like Fox too. It's a quarter of each group, and it's a strident quarter, and it's a tough quarter to reach. But it's not as though it's just these, you know, these either rednecks or hard hats.
And the cultural issues are not, as important as perhaps they were, what, 10 years ago?
Even 10 years ago. And I mean, I was surprised to find that white working class Catholics are more pro-choice than white working class Protestants. They're more pro-gay marriage. A majority of white working class Catholics are both pro-choice, at least under some circumstances, and pro-gay marriage. The real issue is the strong evangelical Protestant strain. If you took out the evangelical Protestants from the white working class, it would look even more open to the Democratic Party.
So the Republican Party is the white party, as you say?
The Republican Party is absolutely the white party. 9 out of 10, according to Gallup polls and other polls, 9 out of 10 people who self-identify as Republican voters are white in a country that's only 62% non-Hispanic white, as we say.
This book goes back to Charles Murray in some ways, doesn't it?
It does.
Let's talk about that. I mean, how were you kind of exercised by Charles Murray to move in this direction, write this book?
Yeah. Well, I'll be really honest with you. The title of this book shifted over the months, and it really was reading Charles Murray's Coming Apart, The State of White America, that I woke up in the middle of the night and this was my title, because I was so struck by the fact that, well, let's go back.
Mention the title again. What's the matter with white people?
What's the matter with white people? Why we long for a golden age that never was. And also the we in the title, in the subhead, is important because I wanted to make it clear that I'm white and that, I mean, the picture makes me look pretty white. But, you know, I didn't want it to seem like some outsider attacking this group. And I wrote it from the we perspective for most of the book. But anyway, Charles Murray, as many of our listeners know, was hugely influential in the Reagan Revolution. He provided the intellectual underpinning for We Fought a War on Poverty and Poverty Won. Charles Murray came out with a book called Losing Ground, and it made the case that poverty programs had worsened poverty, particularly black poverty, by reducing the incentives to get married, to work hard, and to have all those middle class values because you could rely on the dole. And even though liberal academics refuted his numbers very convincingly to other liberals, his argument really carried the day in a lot of ways. And it even really provided the intellectual underpinnings, I believe, of President Clinton's welfare reform. It really was, we've created these incentives for people not to work and not to get married. Let's get rid of them. Okay. Fast forward 25 years, and Charles Murray's new book says exactly the same thing about the white working class and the white lower class, as he calls it, that they're falling out of working class and even middle class status, not because our economy has changed or not because of the demise of unions or not because of the shoveling wealth to the top 1%. No, they've fallen out of the middle class because they're not getting married as often. They're having children out of wedlock. They're not working as hard. He even says they're not as honest. And so he's basically saying the same things about the struggling white working and middle class as he said about black people in the 80s. And so it was like, wow, I'm used to the left finding fault with white people, but now even the right is finding fault with white people. White people better start listening to what's being said about them.
Well, now we have also a very divided and split narrative. I mean, on the one hand, government does all, they're moving towards socialism, want it to be taken care of. And then on the other hand, you know, you have to have complete laissez-faire autonomy and government shouldn't interfere and et cetera, which means, I suppose, nobody should be on any kind of a dole. But what's particularly troubling about this polarization, I mean, the polarization itself is troubling, is the fact that, and I think this is where maybe some stereotypes do come in that might be worth examining, the blaming of immigrants and the blaming of minorities by a lot of the white working class for the fact that they've been disenfranchised, feel disenfranchised, and in many cases have no jobs.
Right. They blame the poor and the non-white, to some extent women, instead of the wealthy and the top 1%. And this is sort of the competing narrative that I write about. And it's wrong, of course, she says. Of course it's wrong. But I think that something happened when we were talking about the Southern strategy and the hard hat riots in the 60s and 70s, where there was really the perception – we are very rightly proud. I think I can speak for both of us that we are rightly proud of what was accomplished in the 60s and 70s. We stopped a war. We had a great civil rights revolution, and we had the feminist revolution. I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for that. At the same time, I think that liberals are not often able to admit that it was also a really scary time. It wasn't just this time of jubilation and victory. It was a time when things appeared to fall apart, that there were riots. There were urban riots. The Watts riot happened about a week after Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, and it was immediately seized upon by the right to say, look what you've done. You've told these people they've been mistreated. Literally, the police chief in L.A. said, this is what happens when you keep telling people that they're mistreated. Not that this is what happens when you mistreat people.
It wasn't only the racial riots, though, that were scary. I mean,
right.
Scary enough, particularly that one summer, I guess, of 68. But there was also, weathermen in the streets breaking windows, mostly from privileged homes, from wealthy bourgeois backgrounds.
Both of us, the Army Math Research Center bombing in Madison. I mean, there were terrible, terrible things.
And both of us having working class backgrounds. I mean, I don't know how you looked at it, but I looked at it as being, setting police officers who were mainly working class kids against these privileged kids and resenting them, it was terrible kind of class warfare.
There was, and that was the thing about my father. My father was a strong civil rights liberal and was against the war and marched against the war, but he really hated that aspect of the student left. He felt that pigs, the calling cops pigs, was an Irish slur. I'm not sure there's evidence for that, but the Irish were called pigs.
A lot of Irish in uniforms in those days.
And there were a lot of Irish in uniforms. And really there was that, I think there was that class conflict even in the hard hat riot of 1970, where you had these working class guys who'd worked hard all their lives. Even in 1970, you were starting to feel a little bit of deindustrialization and the threat to those unionized jobs. And they see these kids who had everything that they didn't have, who are now insubordinate and ungrateful and tearing down the society that they loved and that they fought to build. And I think that burning their flags. And I think that that is something that that we don't acknowledge, liberals don't acknowledge, that was very, very fundamental and formational in that backlash against the Democratic Party.
Talking to Joan Walsh, her new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And let's talk about your subtitle for a moment. That golden age that never was what?
It was probably our childhoods. It was probably the 50s, 60s, early 70s. I think that's another thing that, I was in Tampa and it's like the nostalgia for this golden age was just incredibly palpable. And it's very easy for me to say that it's racism or sexism. And of course, there's some of that. But I think it's also important for us to realize that there was this period of time from the Great Depression and World War II to the early 70s where we made a decision as a country that we were going to flatten income inequality. We were not going to have another Great Depression. We were not going to have another World War. The building a vast middle class was going to protect us against communism and fascism, that there was an incentive for everybody, including rich people, to have more people with a stake in society. But government did that. We as a people, we raised taxes. The top marginal tax rates were in the 90s under Dwight Eisenhower. It was JFK who brought them down to 70. We had the GI Bill. We made it easier for people to unionize. We built roads out to the suburbs. We had rural electrification projects in rural America. We built public universities like we went to, as well as public schools. We were really invested in letting people buy homes and get an education. And two things about that, though. I think that a lot of white middle class and working class people really do not remember or accept the extent to which government made their rise possible. And then also, a lot of people were left out of that, particularly African Americans, that all of those great government programs either allowed discrimination or didn't prohibit it. We had restrictive, we moved out to the suburbs, some of us, and we had restrictive covenants out there. I was on a panel with Jeff Canada, who runs the Harlem Children's Zone. And Jeff, like me, lived on Long Island, grew up on Long Island, which was, you know, not that common for an African-American at that point in time. He's about my age. And he reminded me that Robert Moses built some of the overpasses to the parkways of the Long Island suburbs too low for buses to get out. So anybody who wanted to either come out and visit his beautiful beaches or commute on a bus, which is cheaper than the railroads, couldn't do it. It was real. There, so much of what we enjoyed as white middle class people was due to government and affirmatively shut out African Americans. And so you have this misunderstanding, this completely fundamental misunderstanding, where African Americans and Latinos are saying, look at the help you got from government that we didn't get. And a lot of white people are saying, what are you talking about? We got nothing. Why are you complaining? And I think that this too haunts us to this day. But it was a golden age for a lot of people.
It's also fascinating the way you talk about civil rights as being at the center of this in terms of the struggle, and how, from your own Irish Catholic background, the feeling that blacks were savages and looking down on them and everything sort of transferred onto the Irish. I mean, as you take us through this whole history of the United States and the way it develops, and couldn't help thinking about how there's been divisions in a lot of these ethnic communities. I mean, on the one hand, the Irish Catholic community, you see you saw Joe McCarthy, but I mean, right. Pat Buchanan, people on the right, even Ryan saying he's working class, which is sort of a joke. I mean,
total
very
joke.
Privileged guy. But you also see, you know, the Irish Catholic who were fighting for the very kinds of progressive ideals that you're talking about, and fighting for the poor and doing what they felt their religion compelled them to do and the way of helping. And the same is true of Jewish Americans who were, you know, overwhelmingly voted for Obama the last time, but Israel has played its way into this whole discourse. Many of them, you know, Sheldon Adelson, I mean, you have these people who are way on the right, and who buy into essentially this different kind of American dream that's replaced, I think, what you're talking about as the golden age American dream.
Yeah. I mean, I have a chip on my shoulder to some extent, I realized in the course of writing this book, because being part of the left, I really feel that there was an extent to which the Irish were stigmatized as uniquely racist and uniquely fascist and authoritarian. And there's definitely something there. And I write about that in the book. Daniel Patrick Moynihan thought a few of these same things about the Irish, too. At the same time, you know, there's Michael Harrington, there's Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, there's Mother Jones, there's this other tradition of Irish Catholic radicals. And I felt like the left stigmatized the Irish for class reasons.
Well, also, you give a lot of praise for Moynihan, but I kept hearing his voice saying, you know, we need to, actually it was in print, you know, we need to keep the welfare system going because the black family is a matriarchal family, and that made a lot of black people very angry. But let me give out the phone number. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We'd like you to join this conversation. Any questions or comments you have, please do. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or simply go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment and join us that way, or go to our Facebook page, or go to Twitter. We're at KQED Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Joan Walsh, who is now editor-at-large for Salon.com and who grew up in an Irish middle-class family in New York, and says that her family, and many of them were really in the this funny line between middle class and working class, but working class and middle class often do go together. I guess maybe the best definition is one that she gives us for the white working class: non-Hispanic whites without 4-year college degrees who hold non-salary jobs. Now, that's one element of the working class white. Right. The other, of course, are those who are college educated. But you are welcome to join this conversation. We're talking about how the change took place and why it took place for so many working class families moving from the Democratic Party. And what effect do you think these are many of those who, well, President Obama has to worry about, as far if he's going to worry about any demographic, it's certainly the white working class. And what can he do to bring them back, or has he lost them, or are they simply in the other camp of the Romney camp, despite his remarks, that is, Governor Romney's remarks about the 47%? We're sort of analyzing all that and certainly would like your responses, and you can join us at our toll-free number now at 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our handle is @KQED Forum. You can also go to our Facebook page or our webpage, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Let's go to your calls. And Diane, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from San Francisco, but I grew up in New Jersey, probably not far from where your speaker grew up from. We were a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family. My family left New York to get away from the immigrants, and they went to New Jersey, maybe not the best choice. I think one thing that's important to remember is the idea of broken promises and lost hopes. I'm the only Democrat in my family. Both my brothers and my sister have gone over to libertarianism. And when I ask them the reasons for that, what I understand is that they feel that since the promises were broken, they have no trust in anyone. And they can't go to the Democrats because they understand the Democrats as the party of minorities, and they just can't accept that identity. So the promises that were broken in the 50s and 60s to white men in particular, and to white women in support of their husbands, really spoiled my family to be part of the Democrats, because they just were not able to make that jump to identifying with people who did not have. They always wanted to be the people who had, or at least could get.
Diane, I think that's really interesting, and I think a couple things. First of all, when we talk about the 47%, I think that will hurt Mitt Romney. But a lot of people, even who receive some form of government support, who are white working class or formerly middle class, even though they receive that support, they wish they didn't. They don't believe in it. They are taking it in hard times, but they really blame a larger economy that doesn't have room for them. And so I think a lot of what happened in the 70s in particular, you know, 1973, white male wages stagnated for the first time. They've been rising since 47. They stagnated, and then they started to go down, and they're still going down.
Chris, a lot of this is the turn to a service economy.
Yeah, it's a turn to a service economy. It's not you know, something that the Democrats did. But a lot of these forces that happened in the 70s were also happening at the same time as affirmative action, as we were trying to include more people. And so I think there was the false perception, but the perception that our lot is getting worse, and it's because Democrats and government are helping them. And I think that the Democrats didn't spend enough time talking about those changes in the economy and trying to stay tethered to those white workers who were falling out of the middle class. So I think that's a really great comment.
And we thank you for the comment, Diane. And let me get some comments that are coming in by email. Here's Dave. I wonder how you respond to this. He says, until black neighborhoods have crime rates similar to white neighborhoods, there will always be a large amount of quote-unquote racism in the politics of white working class people. The shocking prevalence of violent crime among blacks sends white voters to whatever party doesn't cater to blacks. Ms. Walsh doubtless thinks this is ugly, but it's true.
I think it's rather ugly. Having spent a lot of time reading about my Irish Catholic immigrant forebears, you know, everything said about African Americans and everything said about crime and drunkenness and laziness and promiscuity was said about my people. It's a function, to me, it's a function of poverty and exclusion. Having said that, I do think crime matters. Crime matters to black people. The crime in black neighborhoods is a horrible thing for African Americans, and there's a perception in those communities that nobody cares because they are black. You know, there's a perception in Oakland that you can have a shooting in Colorado that kills more, you know, that more people are shot in Oakland in a week than, or I better not get that wrong, it might be a month, but then were killed. Shot in Colorado, but the whole nation cares about Colorado and doesn't care about Oakland. So that perception of crime being a problem is widely shared. What to do about it is the question.
Another email. Keith writes, I disagree that the issue is race. The backlash has as much, if not more, to do with the culture and opening the doors widely to social liberalism. Despite what creative pollsters say, the majority of Americans do not support gay marriage when it comes to actually voting in the ballot box. Most Americans want to have a secure border that keeps out human traffickers, drug dealers, gun runners, terrorists, as well as illegal immigrants. Most working people are from immigrant stock and respect that, but they do not want to risk giving up their jobs and livelihoods to illegal immigrants who have not waited their turn. And they have lost many jobs in construction, manufacturing, and hospitality services, just to mention a few.
I think that immigration is a legitimate worry and problem, and I think that it's an issue that's been demagogued. It's one of those rare issues that I think you can honestly say has been demagogued on both sides. I think people do want secure borders. I also think that the idea of throwing out 11 or 12 million people who came here illegally but contribute is problematic, and the two parties can't get together on a solution that would both really secure our borders as well as create a pathway, a legal pathway to citizenship.
Here's Jennifer. Jennifer, join us. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in regards to the Asian American community. I am a second generation Vietnamese American, and Vietnamese Americans have typically voted Republican historically. Not sure why, but I wanted to pick your brain in terms of, you know, where the opportunity is for whether it's Obama or Mitt Romney to gain that Asian American voting bloc.
Jennifer, that's a really good question. I, you know, having written about politics here in San Francisco since the 80s, I never took it for granted that Asian Americans would be a Democratic constituency. I think that people who've come from communist countries, from oppression, understandably are a little bit, you know, skeptical of government. I think that, frankly, the racism of a lot of the Republican appeal has pushed Asian Americans and Latinos into the Democratic Party, but it may be a temporary alliance. You know, I know that Vietnamese people have voted Republican. I'm not sure where that's going in 2012, but I think that the persistent, you know, Representative Trent Franks around the same, the sex selection abortion issue made it a racial issue, claimed that Asians and Asian Americans were the ones, you know, basically having girl babies aborted. Totally a lie, and also just an unnecessary provocation and demonization of a racial group. They have stepped on their message of less government and business friendliness, which might have been more palatable to some Asian American communities, in favor of a racial message, and they're paying for it.
We're getting, and I thank Jennifer for the call, a lot of responses, as perhaps you can tell, along racial lines. I would throw out the question to listeners about how much you think split is racial and how much of it is class, and can the two even be separated? I think it's an important question that Joan's book raises. And again, the book is What's the Matter with White People? And if you want to weigh in here, it's 866-733-6786. In fact, here's a website comment from Rufus who says, white people suffer from the same problems that people who are non-white do. We should all be very skeptical of people who want to divide Americans along racial lines. If you look closely at their income, often you'll find they are paid operatives working on behalf of the criminal 1%. We should also be skeptical of people who want to make us all very envious of other people and make us very greedy. This is standard technique used by the 1% to undermine any socialistic efforts that might achieve justice for the multiracial 99%. Whether it's the goods, largely goods of the spirit, attendant to being born white, or the money inherited from parents or gained using the means they have provided, a notional possession may be defended all the more vehemently for its being largely or fully unearned. There again, all that emphasis on race, but also sounds like, you know, the language of the Occupy movement, the 1%,
right.
Even the criminal 1%, as it's called.
Right.
How much do you feel that... you, wise observer of all these things, that you can't separate race from class from race?
I think it's very hard, you know. But one thing that I try to do in the book is look at, you know, the emerging white minority. You know, I think that the idea we still have white privilege, and it largely lies in what I described before, that superstructure of opportunity and help from government that our families got earlier that others didn't get. But at the same time, I think you have more white people falling into poverty. You have higher white unemployment is much higher. I mean, African-American unemployment and poverty is still more pervasive. But as things become tougher for white people, perceiving them as you know, the top 1%, or perceiving them as always having the power, always having the privilege in every situation, I think is both inaccurate and politically dumb. And I really came to those conclusions living here in San Francisco, where, you know, you can be in San Francisco, first of all, in the better public schools and the University of California system, the Berkeley and UCLA. Whites are a minority. They have been since the 90s. I mean, I think you and I have had conversations about that going back almost 20 years.
We have. I'm also struck by your use of the word superstructure, which is a word that people who've read Terry Eagleton know intimately, because it's often, in fact, a word that's associated with socialist thinking. When, as soon as you get off on this kind of trajectory, that's the accusation that's spewed out, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not a socialist. I'm a social democrat. I'm a capitalist who believes that there's a lot of room for government to make capitalism equitable and fair and blunt the edges. And
that's what we're hearing from Governor Romney too, right? We want to make capitalism fair and available and accessible to everyone, and that
means cutting taxes for the rich and raising them on the poor.
Yeah, but it's also talking to that other narrative. It's saying if you allow people to use their resourcefulness, their entrepreneurship, American inventiveness, all of that will pay off tremendously and have, you know, benefit for everyone.
If that were true, the eight Bush years would have been the most prosperous in our history. We slashed taxes. We slashed regulations. We let the banks go wild. We let the top 1% go wild. And it destroyed the country. So I really don't understand why we're having this, how we can have this debate, how they can just propose the same solutions that we tried for 8 years and think that people are going to fall for
it. Not the same solutions, more of the same
solutions.
More of
the same solutions.
Yeah, doubled.
Oh, I hate that. I hate the expression.
The double down. Yeah, we've been hearing a lot of that, haven't we? Here's Jenny, who says, in Northern California Congressional District 1, we have a Republican candidate, Doug LaMalfa, whose campaign posters show a cowboy hat hanging on the tagline, "He's one of us." Go figure. Not hard to figure. Here's Susan, who says, thank you for the show. It's an interesting and important topic. I think one of the behind-the-scenes factors shaping white anxiety right now is the demographic shift we're experiencing. America will soon be majority-minority, and I think that especially for people who have always lived in the homogeneously white communities, this seems scary. This anxiety is fostering an us-versus-them mentality and a weakening of the social compact. There's a lot less motivation to devote resources toward social support of your fellow citizens if you see them as them instead of as us.
I agree. I do agree. But I also think that, you know, the book calls for empathy for at least some of those people who aren't diehard racists, but who are anxious and who don't know what this world is going to hold for them.
And we go to more of your calls. And we go to Nancy next. Nancy, you're on. Hi.
Hello. Hi. I totally agree with your premise that Obama being of a biracial marriage is a factor. I grew up in very conservative East Texas, and I don't think that that's something that's spoken, but I think that it is definitely a factor. And I think the birth certificate factor is there, too. I would agree with you that it is racist, and before in the campaign between Obama and McCain, one of the legal newspapers had an article about McCain being born in the canal zone,
right,
and that technically there could have been more of a legal issue with John McCain's citizenship than Obama's. It never came to the fore. And so I think it really is an issue, and being in Hawaii makes it even more of an issue because that's other. Again, that is a different place than most people think of as white America.
Well, forgive me, Nancy. This is also a president who spent a number of years living in Indonesia.
So, right.
I mean, there was a lot of talk about how wonderfully global that was on one side, but on the other hand, it made him less of an American in the eyes of many.
Yes.
Oh, exactly. And his mother was, studying all these strange cultures.
Yeah, have you seen the Dinesh D'Souza film, by the way, Joan?
No, Michael, I haven't had a moment to see the Dinesh D'Souza film.
I'm sorry, Joan. I had a reason this with Joan because it's a film that really tries to, well, pick apart the influences of Obama, not so much the birther stuff, but those who, including his mother, who had an influence perhaps in shaping his thinking, and seeing them all as being, well, essentially socialists or on the left or radical thinkers, subversive thinkers.
Right. No, have you seen it?
No.
Oh, yeah. We'll save our money for something else.
Thanks, Nancy, for your call. And we'll go to another caller. Fran, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. The problem of racism began long, long ago when white people first came to this country. And with the demeaning of anyone of a different color, particularly the Native Americans, of course, and the cruelties that arose from that. I'm white, and I'm from Darien, Connecticut, which was and still is to a certain extent a very white community, and which had the restrictive covenants and the very conservative politics and so forth. What I see as the root of all racism is fear. Fear of the different, fear of the other. And this is not easily resolved. It expresses itself in infinite ways. And in the 60s in Los Angeles, I started some interracial encounter groups, and it was immediately revealed that the most liberal of people had in their hearts that same fear and that same resentment of the other. And we tried to sort of bring that to the fore and to work on it from that level. But this is a problem that is so deep in the human psyche. And for a whole variety of reasons, it's not going to be easily resolved, but it's something that has to be addressed at a very profound level.
Thank you, Fran. I appreciate hearing from you. When we think about working class, that's what we've been talking about here, just the word working, I mean, there's a whole work ethic behind a lot of this division that we're talking about. The idea that, well, is implanted in since Calvinist and Puritan times, that Americans need to follow a work ethic and devote themselves to work. And the idea of a lot of this racial division seems based on the idea that certain people don't want to work.
Right.
Or they don't have the desire to work. I mean, and a lot of it's racial. I mean, look at Birth of the Nation. You know, they take
right.
over and you have the blacks sitting there and they're, you know, essentially all they want is to pass legislation for miscegenation and eat watermelon or whatever, you know, and not work.
Right.
I mean, made by a Klansman. Brilliant filmmaking, but nevertheless, embedded in that, and so much of American culture is this idea that people on welfare queens and all that talk, I mean, these are people who don't want to work, whether they're black or now poor white.
And going back to the Irish, I mean, the stereotype about the Irish were that they wanted to drink. I mean, the temperance movement was heavily geared to the Irish or to keeping out the Irish. And the earliest debates about the working poor, probably not the earliest, but very early debates were the 1850s in New York City, where Democrats back then were the racist party, but they were the party of the white emergent working class. And there were the first public works programs during the panic of 1857-1858 were denounced as basically A, trolling for the votes of Irish Catholics, and B, basically helping the unworthy poor who didn't want to work and sapping their work ethic. And the irony of it too at the time was that the free blacks in New York City were perceived as much harder working, cleaner, less drunk, less prone to drunkenness. And the missionaries of that time wanted to keep the blacks away from the Irish because the Irish were corrupting the blacks.
Well, then you come from black Irish, you found out, right?
My father...
They used to call black Irish.
What they used to call black Irish. And everybody has a different definition of black Irish. My father's was particularly eccentric. He told me that it meant that because we had dark hair and hazel eyes that we were perhaps, just perhaps, descended from Moors and Spaniards who mixed with the Irish, and that we might be part black ourselves, and therefore, how could we ever be prejudiced against black people? And I really don't think that there's any anthropological or biological truth to that story, but it made a huge impression on me.
Talking about a huge impression, I don't know why, but it stays my memory, involuntary memory now, a scene out of an old Shirley Temple movie where Stephen Fetchett comes across and he says, I'm Irish, I'm black Irish, you know. It was like a little bit of humor at the expense or whatever. We're going to go to more of your calls in a moment. Let me go to some more emails. This listener, J. Michael, writes, a new dynamic in American elections will be Hispanics. This is the next group of voters that Democrats may begin to lose. Largely Democrat today, they're Catholic and working class, which makes them conservative on social and cultural issues, the economy, and liberal on environmental issues. If the Republicans fix immigration before the Democrats, Hispanic voters will go to the Republicans. What does your guest think? Well, you know, President Obama was just on television, one of the Spanish-speaking television stations, saying, biggest mistake I made. It's a remarkable statement. Biggest mistake I made is not remedying or fixing the immigration situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the emailer is somewhat correct. I think that you know, Karl Rove and George W. Bush really believed that they could, that they would and could grab the Latino vote, and it's really just because of the strident racism. I mean, in our state, going back to those Pete Wilson ads, you know, they're coming over the border and really demonizing and lumping all Latinos in as illegal immigrants again. I guess they're hardworking. I haven't figured this out. They want to work, but we don't want them. Other people don't want to work.
It's a curious kind of a paradoxical xenophobia. Yeah, they're taking jobs, but right. At the same time they don't want to work.
Yeah.
So it's like
they're coming for our services and our jobs. Whatever. It's racism, and it really cost the Republican Party a generation of Latino support. There's no prayer of turning this dynamic around in the next 4 years.
Here's Alex emailing us all the way from Freiburg, Germany, who writes, "You mentioned that some, if not many, working class people will vote for Romney. This is something that I simply cannot comprehend when I observe the position, background, and policies of each candidate. Would you care to comment on why a working class American who is familiar with the issues and politics of the current Republican Party could possibly vote for Romney? From a European perspective, at least, this seems completely crazy."
You'll have to read the whole book. No, I think that because some people have been so hardened to the Democratic Party and so strongly believe that it's the party of minorities and freeloaders, that they just won't even take a second look. They don't know necessarily his stands. They don't care.
We'll go to more of your phone calls, and let's get Bradley on next. Bradley, welcome.
Oh, good morning, Michael and guests. It seems like you're avoiding the main issue is not the identity politics, but the class issues of the parties. I mean, both the Democrats and Republicans, you know, are the bosses' parties. And so this narrative that the dole and the special endowments and stuff are going to working people is so ridiculous. It's the farm subsidies, it's the corporate subsidies, it's the tax breaks. These are the real issues, and the Democrats really aren't fighting on those issues, so people are abandoning them. And a lot of what you know are saying for individuals is true, but it's the bigger economic issues that are involved in people, like, trying to figure out politically where to go, it seems to me. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad you're doing this study, but you're missing the main point of politics in the country right now.
You think Joan Walsh is missing a point about corporate corporate advantages? Go ahead, Joan. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Bradley. I mean, I said it earlier, and I say it throughout the book. One of the main reasons that the Democratic Party lost the working class, I don't think it's racism as much as the Democratic Party moved toward corporate America, became the party of Wall Street. Barack Obama was the candidate of Wall Street in 2008. Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York. If you want to know why Mitt Romney pays those low capital gains tax rates, look at the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party. I say that throughout the book, so I don't think I've ignored that at all.
No, and I would attest to that. But Bradley, thank you for your call. I want to get another caller in here from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, I agree with the interplay of race and culture coming out of the 60s and 70s with what you said, you and your guest have said. The comment I wanted to make is, it seems to me what we're facing now is structural unemployment that is perhaps different than we faced in the past. And so you have successful Asian Americans, African Americans, white Americans, a lot of international people playing in the job market, and people who are left behind in the old economy. They don't have the support of unions anymore. It's a free-for-all, and I think it's causing a kind of fear that they really can't see the future of this. And I mean, how it's playing with the politics, you know, Democrat or Republican, I'm not sure, but I think it's a substantial fear that we're facing now, and that I don't think is really being addressed. I think Obama's actually addressing it with a lot of the changes he wants to make with new energy and so on. But anyway, I'd just be interested in your thoughts on that.
I think you're right. I think that Obama has addressed it since 2008, but I think his message has become much stronger about needing to address structural unemployment and needing to address the people who are left out of this economy of every race. And, you know, my personal feeling is that that's part of why he's doing better with white voters and the white working class and with all voters, because he's got a much more populist, we're going to look at the future and do this together message than he had even a year ago.
Do you think he's going to bring more in than perhaps some of the polls seem to suggest?
I do. I mean, I think it's very possible that we're looking at the bottom falling out of the Romney-Ryan candidacy. And, there, you know, again, I don't want to be over-optimistic. I am a Democrat, so I'll say that over-optimistic. But I do think so. You know, that study that I wrote about last week about the white working class, Barack Obama is ahead in the Midwest with white working class voters. If you take the South out, you know, and that's a big thing to say take the South out. But if you take the South out of all those studies, he's running even in the Northeast and the West, and he's run Obama is running ahead in the Midwest. So, you know, and I think to the last caller, to the last two callers, I think that is a function of the auto industry restructuring, which saved so many manufacturing jobs, not just in autos.
Ironically, the son of the head of General Motors, too.
said let Detroit go bankrupt.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Joanne, join us. Hi, welcome.
Hello, welcome. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just love your show, Michael. And one of the things that's happened to me is I have very close friends who are intellectual, Jewish professionals who have been lifelong Democrats and have become fanatical Republican Tea Party types. Fox News, avid watchers, and I work so hard to understand what's happened to them. And this discussion is very helpful. But the caller who made the comment that the Democratic Party was the party of minorities, I just hadn't thought about that before, and it has never struck me that way. And that one thing, and then also the whole issue about Israel is something that I haven't been able to grasp and understand, and I wondered if you had any comments about either of those.
Well, some quick cogent comments from Joan, because we're short on time here. Joan Walsh.
I don't know many Jewish Tea Partiers, but yes, the issue of Israel, if you go back to 1967 and the Six-Day War, the split in the liberal coalition around Israel is another factor.
A lot of Jewish people don't trust Obama. They don't. Yeah. I mean, because he acted sort of sour with Netanyahu and in ways that they felt were inappropriate to the chief of state of Israel. And clearly those two don't get along.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other subject for another day. And thank you, Joan. What's the Matter with White People? Subtitle, Why We Long for a Golden Age. It never was. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening and another hour ahead. We're going to talk about critical mass in the hour ahead, 20 years later, and what's its future. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.